Hello and welcome to Home to Her, the podcast that's dedicated to reclaiming the lost and stolen wisdom of the sacred feminine. I'm your host, Liz Kelly, and on each episode, we explore her stories and myths, her spiritual principles, and most importantly, what this wisdom has to offer us right now. Thanks for being here. Let's get started. Hey, everybody, and welcome to today's show. This is Liz joining you from Central Virginia in the United States in the ancestral lands of the Monacan people. And before we jump in, I want to give you one more reminder to grab your tickets for Revelry. So if you're a listener, you probably heard me mention this a few times before. Revelry is an intimate online gathering with performance art, ritual, and women's wisdom in celebration of all the abundance of the harvest season, which is fast upon us. And I'm hosting this in collaboration with Girl God Books and She on the Tip of Her Tongue. And the magic happens on Saturday, September 25th, beginning at 3 p.m. Eastern time, but it is a global celebration. You can get your tickets today at revelrycelebrations.com, and I will put that in the show notes in case you didn't catch that. And I also want to let you know that you still have time to join me in a lineup of pretty incredible teachers for the upcoming 12-week online course, The Call of the Wild Feminine, which kicks off September 28th. And I've got a discount code for you here. Listeners can use the code HOMETOHER20 to get 20% off the entire course. That is HOMETOHER20. So you can learn more at wildfeminine.co, and this will be in the show notes too. So, one of the most interesting aspects of my own exploration of the sacred feminine these days is the question of sacred activism. If our spiritual path doesn't call us to transform how we show up and engage with the world, then honestly, I don't think it's doing very much for us. But the way I grew up, showing up in the world, I'm putting that in air quotes, was most likely akin to proselytizing or missionary work, which is really just about convincing people that our path is the right and only way. Well, I'm not particularly interested in this kind of spirituality, and exploring sacred feminine wisdom has never meant for me that we need to swap a male face of God with a female face, and that I then need to convince everyone that they need to agree with me. For me, it has been the invitation I desperately needed to wake up to the sacredness of all life and to reclaim those parts that I've rejected in myself or that our culture has rejected for not being in alignment with the rigid parameters of patriarchy. And then using this awareness to show up in the world differently in small and large ways, whether that's consciously exiting systems and jobs that don't serve my soul or humanity, to what I teach my children, to taking time to honor the seasons and express gratitude for the sunrise every day, and to how I look for ways to help and serve in the world. Well, I don't know that my guest today would use the language the sacred feminine to describe their own spiritual paths, but I do know that we share a vision of sacred activism and the sacredness of life, and I am truly inspired by how they are giving their lives to create better outcomes for all beings on earth. Christabel and Ruby Reed are sisters and the creative force behind Advaya, a global platform for alternative education and transformative experiences that sits at the intersection of ecology, well-being, and spirituality. As they say, they are building a community of change makers around the principles of radical regeneration and joyful change. Saying that just makes me want to smile. Since they founded Advaya in 2015, the sisters have organized more than 150 events, including full-day immersions, panel discussions, retreats, pilgrimages, circles, and festivals, and focused on topics like climate justice, indigenous wisdom, conscious activism, and wild feminine ways of knowing. Christabel holds a master's degree in traditions of yoga and meditation and has completed extensive training in the field of yoga therapy. With Ruby, she is also the co-founder and director of the Charity Initiative Earth, as well as the co-founder of the educational initiative Eco Resolution, which encourages people to step forward in the face of ecological collapse. Ruby is a trustee of the educational charity Resurgence Trust, the director and co-founder of the Charity Initiative Earth, and part of Be the Earth Foundation's Flow Funding Network, radicalizing top-down funding. She has a prior background in art and holds multiple master's degrees. And both Ruby and Christabel have been quite active in Extinction Rebellion, which we have talked about on the show a few episodes back. You might remember that. So Ruby is joining us from Spain today, and Christabel is joining us from London. Ruby and Christabel, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much, Liz. It's really great to meet you, and it's great to be here too.
Yes, thank you.
So the first question, I'm going to say it in jest, and then I'm going to promise you we're actually going to come back to this, but I want to say half in jest, how do you sleep? When do you find time to sleep? Because I read off everything that you're doing, and it's quite impressive and also a little, I'm losing the word, daunting.
Well, I think Christabel and I have worked together now on Advaya. We launched Advaya back in 2015. And since then, we've been continuing to work with Advaya, but we also launched Initiative Earth, the charity, and Eco Resolution, and we've worked alongside each other at various other stages. And also, I think it's just when it comes down to support at the end of the day, like having somebody always there to support you, you can look to for inspiration, and you can look to when you need additional help. And that's what's helped us to do everything. I would never have been able to do any of it alone. And I think that just because like all humans need each other, and somehow working with a sister, a lot of people presume to be difficult, but it's been the most incredible gift. And we often joke about personalities and characters kind of being opposite, but it's also been something that has really allowed us to grow in different directions and spread our wings really in exciting ways. Maybe Christabel will say something very different, but that's what I would say.
No, not at all. I feel completely the same way. And it's really like sweet because I guess growing up and still today we have kind of characters are quite contrasting. And I guess growing up, that could be cause of conflict or distance between us. But yeah, as we grew older and we found that we shared the passions and visions of thriving worlds and kind of becoming present to life and re-enchanting ourselves with the world around us and healing our relationship with ourselves. And I guess through the different creations of Advaya and Initiative Earth and Eco Resolution, we've been able to really balance each other. So we're able to be a really solid kind of force together. And working with Ruby kind of makes me feel like I can do anything, which is really special.
I love that. And so now I'm curious, you know, in what ways do you think you complement each other? Like what skill sets do you think each of you brings to the table? And maybe Christabel, I'll start with you.
I always find these questions really hard because I feel that the way that we work together is really fluid. So I find it really hard to put out particular characteristics, but I know other people would probably be able to, and perhaps Ruby would as well. Ruby, do you want to have a go?
Well, I think we joke sometimes about our doshas, our Ayurvedic doshas. Mm-hmm. We both studied yoga therapy. We did a 4-year yoga therapy training on the back of our previous like yoga teaching. And that took us on a real journey of understanding our constitution and how we might understand constitution in the kind of Ayurvedic tradition, and which is based on elements, and in according to this like elemental understanding, I was very much always in fire, and when I'm out of balance I'm more in this fire, but when I'm in balance I would be like have a vision and like quick and those types of things, able to see things into the future and kind of have ideas. And same with the air, which is also part of that, like when I'm out of balance that would send the fire raging, or completely unable to do anything, but when it's in harmony kind of that. And then Christabel was often characterized by the earth and water element, which was the stability and the grounding and the dedication. And the water is also like fitting to container, you know, like it's, and then like everything is is possible when you have dedication, adaptability and flexibility. And then you can kind of go in a forwards direction when that's brought together with kind of their energy. And I don't know, so we synth together. Like, obviously we have different aspects of our personalities as well, but that are much more complex. I think that's probably one way of looking at it.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's the best way for me to kind of see how we work together, is from like the elemental point of view rather than particular characteristics, because I feel we're always shifting and changing. But I feel that we both have like visions of and ideas of things, but I'll always be a bit more like nervous to kind of go forwards and to do it, because I'm really aware of my like more limited capacity or wanting to be slow and really like thought through and methodical. And then Ruby can be this more like transformative movement forwards to just be like, no, we can do it. Let's go, go, go. So yeah, together it's like we find this good balance. And there's something also to be said for working with a sister where you just love and respect them in a way that you don't love and respect anyone else. Not that you don't love and respect them, but just differently. So so I think that, yeah, so I think kind of being able to work together, you have this like innate trust, and also you don't need to talk about everything all the time because you just know it already together.
I would love to, sorry.
Okay.
I just wanted to add on the back of that, like, I think that you can develop a sisterly relationship with somebody who's not a blood sister, but being a blood sister definitely is a little bit of a head start, because we got over the rocky stages. Whereas sometimes when it's not a blood relationship, you don't go through the rocky stages that makes you so much closer. So I think that's definitely some strength.
I love this. And this brought up two thoughts in my head as you were both speaking. And one of those is just what a refreshing idea to think about the doshas or the elements, however you might frame that, as a way to understand how to work well together. I'm thinking of the more traditional business background, which is where I came from before I began this work, was, you know, you would have things like strength finders. Not that there's anything wrong with strength finders. Those are quite helpful. Or, just different ways of approaching understanding skill sets, but they feel a little bit more rigid. And I find something kind of lovely and fluid about the way that you're talking about it, that I think is, I'm just imagining how refreshing that would be if more organizations worked in that way. I'll pause there in case you wanted to say anything to that.
Yeah, no, I just, it made me laugh a bit inside, because people love abbreviations and like clever ways to understand things that we already knew, you know, like there's so many of these. I don't want to name them because I know they're also very powerful in and of their own right. But there's something happens, I think, when we distance ourselves so much through kind of conceptualization, by like putting numbers or letters or things according to someone's personality. And then you can end up kind of defining someone by that, and they're not able to grow outside of this box that we've got them inside our head. And you can change so much, but in our head, they'll always be that way. And I think it's a great disservice.
Yeah, I agree. The other thing that I thought of too is, so there was, I don't know, a few months back, I had two guests on that host this really wonderful podcast called Missing Witches, where they go out and find these fantastic stories of women who are not always women, but mostly women who, you know, have just been erased from history, but more modern day, that we would call witch. They're using their magical powers for activism, for good, for whatever. And we had this conversation about these stereotypes that we have about women working together. And I think you sort of, I don't remember which one of you now alluded to the idea that maybe sisters wouldn't work together well, but It's funny. I do think there is that idea that, that I don't know, there's some cattiness, there's some competitiveness. And so it's really lovely to hear the two of you describe your working relationship in this way as something that can be beautiful and complementary.
Totally. I think, yeah, I mean, it kind of goes without saying that you want the best for each other and for each, you know, for each other to be as happy as possible and to kind of live their life according to what makes them feel best and yeah, brings them most joy. So I can't imagine working with anyone in a different way, to be honest.
Mm. Lovely. Well, I want to go back for a moment. I typically start off most of these conversations by getting a little sense of grounding of your spiritual experience as children. And I know both of you have quite an extensive background in yoga, but I'm curious what your spiritual background was growing up and you know how that influenced where you are now.
I'll just jump in. For me personally, I think our mum took us to church. She used to sing in the choir, and we would go to Sunday school, and I think she would be teaching at Sunday school as well. I think the presence of being in church and in community and through song and with the kids and learning about Jesus and love and like these kind of aspects of Christianity definitely had a big impact on me growing up and kind of, I think, put me on a spiritual path. And then throughout school, I started to kind of, I don't know, I was just very, at school I was given, I was made to read a book in philosophy by Richard Dawkins called The God Delusion, and it really upset me, the way that he wrote about religion and spirituality. And luckily our philosophy teacher gave us Rupert Sheldrake's The Science Delusion, and that really opened up a lot for me. And there was kind of, you know, that was one moment of many that just really, I think, shifted and oriented myself to a more spiritual path. And then I suffered, and I guess still do, well, not suffer, I have anxiety and like on a kind of daily basis. And so to help manage that, I started practicing yoga and found great relief and joy through that. And so I think, yeah, that's like the kind of the state of my anxiety also really kind of put me on this path of yoga and meditation. And then just experiencing the kind of shift in consciousness and the way that I was relating to myself and the world and the teachings of non-dualism, I think then led me from kind of a spiritual personal practice to this more kind of, I guess, more like activist-y kind of practice of bringing your kind of spiritual life into the way that you're making actions in the world.
Yeah, I would say similarly to Christabel, like growing up, going to church was really important, but it wasn't really kind of traditional church. Like her mum had an understanding of Christianity that was rooted very much in certain aspects of like the institutionalized religion and it ignored other parts. Like it was very much rooted in the message of kind of love and peace, and that was a key part of her teaching to us as well. And joy, there was never talk of like sin or hell or these other aspects of kind of methods that I think the institutionalized religion of Christianity has been used to great disservice and of great danger to the feminine in the world. And so that was really important. And I think I should kind of contextualize that within when we talk about that. And it was a way of relating to the world around us that was almost devoid of kind of any understanding of kind of Godhead as a person. It was about relating to the more something more than and the spiritual outside of each of us, but that is present in all of us too. So it was something much more mystical. And I think that that has been so important to what we, how we ended up relating to the world around us. And it's what I see is so important for everybody to find that way of relating to the more than or the other than, something that's inside and outside of all of us, but that's not quite our kind of intellectual way of living. And I think like when you can relate in that way, there can be so much hope, and there can be so much beauty as well, and potential and joy and like energy that is so powerful.
Yeah, I'm thinking, and you maybe have kind of already answered this a little bit, Ruby, with what you just said, but well, it's funny, right? Because we're talking about something that's non-intellectual, and now I feel like this might be veering back into the, but how does this all work, linear mind? But I'm curious, like, how each of you, how do you experience the sacred in your lives? Like, what does that look like for you?
I guess it's hard to kind of articulate. For me, it's the sacred. It's about like the acknowledgement or the feeling of being connected to something that is greater than myself, but that which I'm a kind of small but essential part of that whole. That to me is kind of the essence of sacred and for me. And what the other parts of kind of how that can manifest in daily life is when I can kind of really connect to like the extraordinary and the heart of the ordinary, as I think Sharon Blackie says. And really connect to the magic of the everyday and this kind of very special lived experience in this physical body, in this kind of, this like mad existence that we have. But yeah, anyway, going back to the sacred, it's this feeling of being connected to something greater than myself, and having a kind of sacred duty to maintain the relationships in my life, so to kind of uphold that sacred order, if that makes any sense to anyone.
Absolutely. And I'm thinking how lovely this line of work that you're in, that you're able to bring the sacred into your job and your work too. That's quite a gift.
I kind of think that like most things can be sacred. Like, I think another part of, I guess, sacred like duty, or like from perhaps the perspective, like a dharmic perspective, is taking action to create harmony where disharmony has occurred. So my studies of the Bhagavad Gita at SOAS really, really, really inspired me so much. And I think kind of lay a foundation or a framework for how I came to understand something like spiritual or sacred activism. But it's this understanding that kind of existence is about relationships and interrelationships with yourself, with people, with the world, with ecosystems, with the cosmos, with, you know, and then however you understand the more than human kind of beings. But that through our daily actions, we can because everything's in constant flux and change, it's only through action that we can create more harmony in those relationships. And in that act of creating harmony, you uphold that sacred order. And that order is what can create thriving life within and without.
I love that.
I think we can also bring the sacred in through just our ways of seeing. And I think that that can come through practice as well. It's like spending for a very personal level for me, spending time alone in nature was a really transformative kind of gradual process of seeing like the beauty of the natural living world and the beauty of its systems in a more and more intricate and complex way. that then can kind of see all systems that align with natural systems to be similarly, can be similarly sacred, like whether it's relationships of mutual support and trust and love between humans, something you can't even see, but you can see the relationship forming, and that's kind of a system that's aligned with life, and it's beautiful and it's sacred. I think that when you start to see in this way, the whole world opens up. And I also think then it becomes very easy to identify what isn't sacred. Because sometimes, like, the ugly things, the shadow things can still be sacred when they're kind of put to the service of a natural system, like death. Death is horrific, but it's also a celebration of the life that just was. It's the passing through to another type of existence. And in that, it's extremely beautiful. It allows life to continue. Because if nothing ever died, nothing would live at all. But then there's also recognizing when the shadow is not part of a system that is supporting of life and beauty. And I think that's when discernment comes in. And I think discernment is really, really key. And I think especially in the world of spirituality, there is so much fake, and there is so much that is not aligning, and not aligning with more life. that's quite the opposite. Yeah.
Mm. And is that your tell then? When you speak of discernment, is that how you know it's fake, if that it doesn't seem like it's in service to life? Or what would you say about that? Because I feel that too, and I also feel there are a lot of people who are confused, you know, and yeah, kind of fumbling.
Yeah, I think it is really, really hard. I don't know. I think it's very personal too, and so there's no. But for example, an example for that I experienced this morning, somebody was talking to a mutual friend who's in invest money, and he is investing money in heavy industry in India, which obviously is going to be environmentally impactful, it's going to be socially impactful, and it's going to have catastrophic effects. Like, his investment is going to enable kind of human rights abuses, environmental abuses, and the perpetuation of a system that is causing the devastation of the earth. And in his mind, it's a great thing to do because he can then have a lot of money. Mm. And then that's good because then he can give money to charities.
Yeah.
That support nature.
Yeah.
And that's just like such a strange way of thinking, but it's actually a way of thinking that many people have in our system. I'm sure guilty of that. Such as when I, in a very different way, not financially, I might be mean to my sister. Based on the fact that, oh, it's fine because tomorrow I'll be really nice to her and I'll make up for it. But but we're not being honest. we're not being honest. When there's not honesty, there's like a part of the bargain isn't there, and it's not gonna move forwards in the right way. And it's like, how can we be authentic? And by honest, I also mean authentic. And how can we be authentic? And how can we be honest? And how can we tell the truth, even when it means that it might not have the initial outcome that we hope for? I think often as well, it's like, it's different ways of working and different ways of relating. I'd love to talk about later the partnership paradigm and the domination paradigm that Rianne Eisler teaches, because I think it's always so related.
That's exactly what I was thinking as you were talking, Ruby.
Yeah.
If I can quickly just add a point about discernment. Ruby and I used to do a leader workshop like a few years ago called The Roots and Fruits of Our Actions, which is about looking at what is the root of your action. And I think when trying to make a decision or trying to understand the intentions of someone else or the kind of integrity or authenticity of a project or an action, it's to kind of go back to what's at the root of this, like what's driving this. Is it clarity, seeing reality kind of, you know, beyond the veil, or is it rooted in fear or ego or anger or desire or attachment, or ignorance, and which is like non-clarity? And if it is, then the effect and the fruits of that action are not going to be like, they're not going to be contributing to a thriving life paradigm or a partnership paradigm, because that's going in the opposite direction. I use that a lot when I'm making my own decisions, whether it's like, do I want to go to the pub and see my friends? Or is it about doing a different course or starting a new venture or going somewhere like or doing a master's? And in from like the smallest to the biggest of actions, I find I can be more discerning when I go back to like really what is it at the root of this that's making me want to do it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Was also thinking, and I mean, you use this language, I think both of you did, the paradigm. I was thinking, Ruby, of the example that you're giving of your friend that feels very, or I don't know, even know if you said it was a friend, but someone, you know, that feels very old paradigm to me. And I think this systems of domination, systems of partnership is such a good way to frame that, but it's so common. I think it also to me is a hangover of a colonizer mindset. You know, we're still kind of controlling the resources to enrich ourselves, but we will give back. We will give back and bring our, you know, something without acknowledging the harm that's being done from that system in the first place. I think that's such an important conversation to have.
Yeah, totally, totally, totally. I mean, just say a little bit more perhaps about how I understand that if people don't know Rianne's work.
Yeah, and I just want to mention The Chalice and the Blade is a really fantastic work, and by Rianne Eisler. Go ahead, Ruby. You can just add to that.
Well, I was just going to say that she sees it as a continuum or a spectrum. And at one end is the domination model that kind of defines the culture of the modern world and economy. And at the other is a partnership model, which is life supporting and which aligns with cultures of interrelationship, partnership, mutually beneficial relationships, and reflects the principles of the natural living world as well. And it also sits at the heart of traditional societies and at the root of most world religions, even though I say the root, because the domination model in contrast is defined by hierarchy and power over and value, strength, power, accumulation, linear progress, competition, wealth, and defines the kind of growth-based economy of the world today, and cultures of corporate and globalized capitalism and colonization and competition and extractivism, and they all go on in the same way. And Rianne, I think, is so powerful because she's an older lady, and she was a refugee during Nazi Germany, and in her opinion, it's not about being left or right or man or woman. It's about overcoming this and coming into harmony, because otherwise we're just going to be continually repeating the same systems of domination over and over again. And like I think it is really useful. I say it's not about being man or woman, but it is, I think the lens of gender is still very, very powerful, because the domination paradigm is imbued with power based around labor, decision making, and social hierarchy, which have associations of masculinity to strength and femininity to weakness. Yes. Which has a huge impact on how society functions. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was agreeing with you. Please go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And so, like, all violence is rooted in these relationships of domination, whether it's kind of gender, environmental, racial, religious, class. And there's a kind of real political appeal to that aggressive masculinity, which lies in the fear of losing certain privileges that we see as important within these systems. So, like, people vote to support Trump or Bolsonaro because they fear decision making going into the hands of the people who are seen as weak. And so it's like this binary approach of strength, weakness, masculine, feminine, left, right, east, west, which marginalizes the majority and denies diversity. And like when it comes to the physical world, it's reflected in a mindset accompanied by dogmatic thinking, fundamentalism, and like ideological warfare. Like, we even see it in science right now with there's such science, dogmatic science, if any, and it's used in quite a day. I think the future for science is going to be quite interesting. The way it's replacing religion as a method. Absolutely. without depth or openness, I think.
Right, or recognizing that there are multiple ways of knowing that go beyond data. There are more than one. There is more than one knowledge system, and ways to view the world, and ways to experience knowledge and wisdom. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
We are actually doing the next course, well, not the next one, the one after that we're doing after the Call of the Wild Feminine is with Rupert Sheldrake, and it's called The Big Questions in Science, How to Understand Them and Set Yourself Free from Dogma. Because it's not even that science is becoming a religion, it kind of, for many people, it is a religion. And the issue with that can lie in that at the root of a materialist reductionist worldview lies 10 or more key assumptions, which when you start to inquire into them using scientific inquiry and skepticism, you realize that there is no evidence for this particular worldview. And I think people are so culture, or not culture, but people and people in power can be so fearful of change that they don't want that worldview to change. So it becomes deemed as a scientific worldview, the view that nature is mechanical, that consciousness arises from like the material brain, that memories are etched inside the brain, all these different things that really hold us back from kind of living in a much more open and exciting and curious way. I think that you mentioned at the beginning, talking about ways of being. And I think the more that we can become open to different ways of being and curious, the more we're going to be able to shift out of the particular way of being, this kind of domination paradigm that we're stuck in now. It's like about exploring what's at the root of our attitudes and our values, and why is it that culture values these things if they're not serving people? Like, why are we so hell-bent on them?
Yes. And I'm so glad that we introduced Rhian Eisler into this conversation. And I think this is where I see kind of the dovetailing of what I call it the sacred feminine, because for me, all of these things became present in my life when I started questioning the dominant paradigm that God was a male, and started holding inquiry into the historical evidence that this hasn't always been the case. This hasn't always been the case of how we have envisioned our spiritual practices. And so Rhian's work, I discovered that early on, and it was extremely enlightening for me. And so when I say the sacred feminine, I know that what I'm talking about is, I said this in the beginning, it's not a flip necessarily, but it is a rebalancing. And that lens was what led me to the concept of more of a partnership model, regardless of whether or not, we all know that that doesn't have to be locked up in gender, right? Like I don't know if we all listeners are aware. So I'll just go ahead and say, like, I don't think that male or female have a monopoly on anything. These are just culturally imposed stuff we've thrown on ourselves. But that going back and looking at those things, Ruby, like what you said, that we have kind of labeled as weakness, like we've also labeled that as feminine. And so going back and re-examining that and saying, wait a minute, if we pick this back up, if we re-examine this in a different way, what kind of culture are we building instead is so it's just, I think it's the medicine we need right now.
Yeah, it really is. I'm so excited about the future. Like, both scared and excited when it comes to seeing like how things will change. But I think that what's coming is not going to be like that for a long time. Like the way that all political systems are going, the way that religions are going, I think it will get a lot worse before it gets better. But like when we are talking about culture, I think it's such a it's a powerful term to use, because it also it shows that it's systemic rather than human. It's not nature. It's like when something's systemic, we can change it. And it's not saying that all humans are evil, or men are evil, or women are good, or this is. It's much more. It's much more malleable. On the one hand, it can be very oppressive. Like right now, I think a big reason why people have climate anxiety and overwhelm is because the system seems unsurmountable. Yeah. But on the other hand, it's very, very freeing, and I think that's why the ideas such as the Anthropocene are very dangerous, because according to the Anthropocene, it's not cultural, it's nature. It's like all humans are virus, and we need to protect nature from humans. So there's like scientists like E.O. Wilson, which are fighting, and his whole school of people want humans, wants 50% of the globe to be protected from human touch. So that includes indigenous people, it includes people who have been living and co-evolving with the forest systems and with other ecosystems for millennia. And when we change this understanding to be it's not nature, it's cultural, then we can start to look at the culture and look at how we can change that and what are the problems there, and like, oh, it's a domination, it's a growth-based model, it's colonization, it's industrialization, and then what systems should we be favoring instead?
Yes.
Yeah. I completely agree, and I think it's acknowledging that like the things like the climate crisis is a crisis of culture, and culture is made up of kind of humans and people, and as soon as we see it as something that's cultural rather than innate to the human essence, which I really don't think or believe ever could be, we can really start to understand that it's through human participation and action that we can shift culture, kind of, and obviously, you know, having leaders that would be aligned with the values that we need in order to address socio-economic and ecological crisis is essential. But I think more essential is creating a culture which values the values that we need in order to have that kind of society. And I actually think that feels kind of accessible and possible, because it starts from you and your community, and it can start to grow outwards rather than kind of waiting for leaders to appear out of nowhere, out of a void, to kind of lead the way. It will be too late if we wait for that. And Ruby said that she thinks things will get worse. I can't say that I would say that. I have to be, for myself and for my mental health, like ever optimist that it's not going to get worse and that we're going to be just gently going in a really good direction. Otherwise, mm-hmm. I won't get up for work tomorrow.
Yeah, I absolutely understand that. And I want to come back to this idea of both anxiety and joy, but I just wanted to add on, Christabel, to what you were saying there. I think this is another reason why it's interesting to go back to our spiritual origin stories, because even if we think, or we as individuals are not, you know, like we've chosen to put our emphasis on science, for example, as opposed to religion, there are so many religious origin stories that tell us, well, I mean, it's written right there in the Bible, you know, that God gave man dominion over all beings. And so when we then incorporate that into our reason why we exist, and we give ourselves permission in that way, and then we indoctrinate sounds very combative, but that's the word I've got right now, you know, indoctrinate that into our children, and we institutionalize that into our systems, whether they are religious based or not, then I think for me, I start to see the magnitude of what we're, I don't want to say what we're up against, what we're working with. You know how many metaphors of violence and domination there are in our language, by the way? It's quite mind-boggling.
It's a lot. It's a minefield.
So much. Well, and
that's another one. It's a minefield.
You just said it, and I just wow. I want to come up with a list of these, and I know. Actually, I'll put a link in this to the show notes. Rhianne Eisler did something like this fairly recently with different words that you could use. I don't think minefield was on that list, but there were several good suggestions. So I'm going to put that in the show notes.
That's so cool.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you both about, so you mentioned, Christabel, you mentioned anxiety, and I deal with that as well. I have a 10-year-old daughter who has already some struggles with that. And I know it's not a female thing necessarily. I'm sure there's a whole lot of men and people that don't identify as either who are struggling with anxiety. So I don't mean to characterize it in that way, but I've been thinking lately about the idea of, you know, we look at it as like, okay, we need to heal our personal trauma. And I certainly think that's true. But I do wonder how much of that anxiety is cultural and what we are facing from a climate perspective. And, you know, I think maybe that was Ruby who already kind of touched on that a little bit. So I'd be curious of your thoughts on that. And then, you know, this other piece of joy, which you have both mentioned in this interview, and it's in the information about Advaya. It's like, how do we, in the face of, we rightfully so have so much to be anxious about, where do we find joy? So I'll let either of you.
I'll go in. So I think that anxiety is, in my experience of anxiety, it's felt very cultural, and after quite a long time of my teens of suffering with daily anxiety, I started to do work to kind of trace it back and reflect and trace it back. And it, a lot of the time, it came down to this sense of not being whole, and like I was constantly needing to be something other than what I already was in order to be whatever it was I wanted to be. That made sense. Makes sense. So, and then as I got a bit older and I started looking at capitalism and a growth-based economy and how we're basically told that you never have enough, and like you are what you have, and therefore you never are enough, and that you constantly need to be kind of proving yourself or attaining things that are external to what you already are within, like in your essence. I'm not saying that all my anxiety is because of capitalism, but, you know, I do believe that, like, culturally, those kinds of values, like, are insipid, and they start to go so deep within you and into who you understand who you are and what your place is in the world. So that's one aspect of kind of culture and anxiety. The other one is just feeling, just knowing, being able to envision this world which is centered on nature, which reveres nature, which celebrates and reveres kind of social and personal, collective, ecological well-being, and like the true essence of what well-being is, that everything has the ability and the space and the freedom to kind of express itself in its sacred design, in its balance, and to kind of grow into that like a flower blossoms into its kind of sacred design, but yet that we live in these systems which are so oppressive, which is so oppressive and kind of the opposite of that. And I think that creates also within us like an anxiety, because we are not functioning in an environment which really supports the deepest desires of, I you know, dare I say, humanity, if not for myself. So there's that, and there's lots of other things I could say on anxiety. When it comes to joy, I think because I practiced
I think now I can intellectualize it, and it's about a state of mind and a way of seeing. But I think it's only because of like years of practice of connecting to it and through daily practice that I'm able to do that now. So, but for me, it can be kind of flipping a switch sometimes if I'm like really feeling heavy and down and low and stressed by work and overwhelmed and anxious. Sometimes if I'm able to like step a little bit back and give myself perspective and start to follow the beginning, middle and end of my breath and having a pause in between and like, you know, acknowledging like how amazing my hands are and like all the things they can do and, you know, just start to take it really back down to the small and start to see how kind of majestic life is and how lucky I am. And like, in, I mean, there's so many, many, many ways. And then, you know, start to kind of, yeah, just go back to the little things. And from there you can reconnect with joy and like the pleasure of just kind of the present moment.
It's so similar for me as well. Like when it comes to connecting with joy and bringing joy into our lives. And for my practice to get there is so related, like Christabel said, to the flip and the switch in the mind. But I think it's so much also about how I am in my body and how connected I am in my body as to where and how I access feelings of joy. And I think it's partly a way of seeing, but it's also partly a way of relating. I find that when I am in more embodied, then the whole world kind of opens a little bit more. And my practices of being in nature then go a lot deeper. And I feel more at ease with my body and more at ease in the world, and much more open and flexible and adaptable. I try and spend a lot of time in water, and the practice that Christabel was talking about, where you are spending time just really noticing the breath, I do that a lot in water. I find it easy to, not in terms of holding my breath, but in terms of just becoming more and more sensitive to the small feelings of the water on my skin and the small like sounds and what things look like and just the different sensations on a very like minute level. Somehow I find it easier to do in water than I do, say, in a field. And I think it's because you're so immersed, you're literally immersed in it. And the kind of clothes, all the paraphernalia isn't there. You're focusing also just in the water. It's very hard to have many, many, many different thoughts when you're swimming. If you've got your face in the water, it's just the breathing. I try and think, but I find it so hard to think the complex thoughts. It's just like different ideas coming through my mind. And it's such an easy and a quick way for me to enter a different state of being. And through practicing it in water, I then find it much easier to access that place when I'm out of water. So I can be in a forest, similar way of being immersed, but also just sitting in the garden beneath the sky, or looking at the grass, can cultivate that same presence and focus and feeling of connection. And then from those places, I think comes joy, because there's no, there's none of those negative thought forms or things that arise from any type of system that isn't aligned with joy, because as I was saying, like natural living systems are joyful, they're beautiful, they are, and they create more joy and more beauty. So there's not the things that would pull that away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking about this idea of like the more here we are in our bodies in this moment, then the more we realize is actually here, right? Like rather than just our thoughts or whatever. Yeah, there's quite a lot here in this moment if we are just present in our bodies to not just witness it, but to see how we're part of it. Yeah. So I want to ask you, and I did not make this clear in the intro, but the Call of the Wild Feminine course that I mentioned at the beginning is being hosted by Ruby and Christabel by Advaya. So I'd love to hear, and I think we've been talking around this a little bit, but I'd love to know what inspires your interest in this, what you're calling the wild feminine.
It's definitely, from my perspective, an inquiry. The kinds of the topics that we're going to be exploring are things that I don't feel like I've really inquired deeply enough. And it's so easy to kind of simplify and to use big words like the feminine rising without really being like, what do I actually mean by the feminine? So in this course, we're going to be looking, you know, at what many different people from all around the world mean by the feminine in its diverse forms and expressions. And I think by wild, what we mean is free from patriarchy or free from the domination paradigm. Like, what does it mean for the feminine to express itself freely? How is it doing that? And how can we do that within ourselves as well? And it's very much also about exploring the spectrum of the masculine and the feminine and how they interplay together. And, you know, do we see these as on a spectrum, or do we see them as kind of essences? That do we see that they can be within or are within each person, regardless of sex and gender? So it's all these kinds of questions. And I think, you know, through Advaya, everything that we do is about exploring different ways of being. It's about unpeeling the layers that prevent us from expressing ourselves as kind of authentically and truly as we would like. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm coming at with it. And I'm just really excited by, we have a very powerful cohort of kind of authors and psychologists and matriarchs and priestesses and healers and practitioners and thinkers and leaders. And this is going to be a really, really special few months.
Nice. I don't know, Ruby, if you had anything you wanted to add to that or not.
Yeah, I think Christabel summarized it so well. I would see the wild as outside of the control and the auspices and the holdings of this this system that we don't want to be part of anymore. It's the wild feminine, and it is. This wild woman, we were also quite inspired by the wild woman archetype and the work of Clarissa Pinkola Estes.
Oh, yeah.
But we also wanted to distance ourselves a little bit from making the course just about that, because we really wanted to celebrate the many different ways that the feminine appears and the many different ways that the wild feminine might be understood. So we really just wanted to make it the feminine and the call of the feminine outside of how it's understood by the patriarchal system and how it appears within a patriarchal binary.
Got it.
If I can quickly just add that part of my interest in kind of the sacred masculine, sacred feminine, came 6 years ago, and I just stumbled across a video through on YouTube of Pat McCabe talking at Schumacher or Dartington, and we never met Pat at this point, and it was a talk about kind of the thriving feminine design or the sacred feminine design, and it was so interesting, and she spoke about how the masculine and feminine are on a spectrum, and they hold each other, but that because of the power over paradigm, which relates closely to what we were talking about before with Rhianne Eisler's work, with the domination paradigm, you know, suddenly with power over, you come into hierarchy. And when like, it's like almost like the human brain culturally or for whatever reason finds it very hard to kind of celebrate and like reveal a spectrum of identity and of being and of ways. And so instead it's one or the other. And if it's one or the other, which one is the powerful one and which one must be the submissive or oppressed one? Also coming from this like feeling of like scarcity and like the power is something that we must like covet rather than share, which is, I think, like to me, power means like thriving fully. And I don't think you can thrive fully if you feel like you're in scarcity, but anyway. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of part of what I'm really interested in is like, yeah, like shifting out of that power over to celebrate and connect to, you know, the feminine or the masculine and whatever that means on a big spectrum. And the other part of it is that as a teenager and like, you know, a woman growing up and seeing my male friends be trying to fit into these boxes of what it is for them to be a man and a success in life, actually more so than it was for my girlfriends to be trying to be what it was to be a woman. I've seen more pressure on my guy friends. And I think that's something very interesting as well. Like, how is it that the kind of this perceived masculine archetype that men are brought up to believe they need to aspire to in order to be manly, in order to be powerful, in order to be respected, how that is like having such a negative effect on mental health and also then on the way, because we kind of now like have this thing where we look to leaders to be portraying these supposedly masculine qualities, which are themselves, I don't believe, part of the masculine archetype. Or even or perhaps it is, but perhaps there's many different kind of archetypes. I'm feeling a bit rambly, but I don't know if I've made my point. But it's just, I think we have such a constricted understanding of the feminine and the masculine. And even if, you know, we say that gender doesn't exist and these archetypes don't exist, but they are so represented in culture and they have such a big effect on politics, on society, on mental health, on our environment, on the way that we start to relate to the world around us. And so I think it's so important that we start to really unpick that. And I did a lot of work at university in my history BA looking at the construction of masculinity and femininity in like pre and post colonial and during colonial and like imperialist times. And it was just so interesting to see the cause and effect of how these very tight archetypes of man and woman came about and how that then affected politics and social justice as well. So yeah, there's so much there that I think is so important for us to inquire into, as well as trying to overcome the very binary nature in which we see both masculine, feminine, man and woman.
Oh my gosh, I feel like this could be a whole different podcast. Like there's so much there. And I so agree with you. As the mother of a six-year-old son, does not matter where you are, these like sort of rigid boxes that we try to put our children in are there. And that culture tries to put your children in. And you know, I agree with you. I see it coming at my male child more than it's coming at my female child. And I, as the wife of a man who is actively, you know, trying to unpack this, you know, this masculine, rigid masculine box that he's been told to fit in, I see that very much. So I just want to actually speak it out into the universe right now that this is a conversation I would absolutely love to have on the show in the future. With the male-bodied person who wants to explore kind of what it means to be stuck in that rigid version of masculinity and what it would mean to reclaim the feminine. So there, it's out in the world. May it come back at some point. Ruby, I don't know if you wanted to add anything there. And then I'm going to suggest that this feels like a really good place for us to wrap up.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is a good moment to close. I really like that we've come back to the to kind of a reevaluation of the masculine and the feminine together, and a celebration of the feminine within everything and within us all. And yeah, because I'm excited for that, what happens when we can bring these different energies into harmony within us. And like we were joking at the beginning about overcoming the rocky patches in the sibling relationship to come into greater harmony, where the two threads can be kind of going and moving alongside each other in a harmonious way. Like, I think that there's so much to be said for the masculine and the feminine coming into balance together, and it's such a kind of beautiful promise that we'll hopefully make some steps towards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, may it be so. Well, Ruby and Christabel, I want to thank you so much for your time. This has just been such a, this conversation has been very nourishing to my soul. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you
for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. And so if people want to learn about you and your work, it's advaya.co. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and
it is for the time being. We might change it. But yeah, look up Advaya and Advaya on Instagram and the website. And currently, until we build our new website and platform, we have different websites. So there's there's wildfeminine.co. There's also the Rupert Sheldrake course, which is the bigquestionsinscience.com. We'll soon be launching a course called Bodyfulness, which is exploring the relationship between embodiment, social justice, and somatics, and like trauma. But you can find everything through the website Advaya still.
Yeah, and the website for the Bodyfulness course is embodimentandsomatics.com.
Okay, excellent. And I'll get all of these from you, and we'll put them in the show notes. So if you don't have a way to jot this down quickly, fear not, you can go look there. And yeah, absolutely. And I want to thank all of you listeners, as always, for being here with me. It is truly my heart's joy to share this show with you. So if you enjoy it, please do me a favor. Tell a friend about it if it would be beneficial to them. You can subscribe, you can leave it a favorable review. You can do all those things. And if you have feedback, send me a note. You can always send me a message, liz@hometoher.com. I want to hear everything. I want to hear your suggestions for the show. I want to hear what you like, what you don't like. So yeah, talk to me. And until next time, I will be with you again very soon. Home to Her is hosted by me, Liz Kelly. You can visit me online at hometoher.com, where you can find show notes and other episodes. You can read articles about the sacred feminine, and you'll also find a link to join the Home to Her Facebook group for lots more discussion and exploration of her. You can also follow me on Instagram at Home to Her to keep up to date with the latest episodes. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you back here soon.